Pieces come and go, and I'm forever grateful. Come and tell me long and slow exactly what I wait for. Better times, yeah, better times. Somehow I don't believe it. I built a house up long ago just to up and leave it.
Welcome to On the Wing Podcast, fueled by Purina Pro Plan. With special thanks to this, for this particular episode, also to Sport Dog Brand e-collars. This is a special edition episode brought to you by Sport Dog about bird dog training. And today you're going to hear a familiar voice, friend of mine who you've heard on the podcast before, professional dog trainer Mike Wieben. As you may recall, he's been on a number of times talking about training retrieve, train to retrieve, get my vernacular right, yeah. For Gitche. I was thinking most recently you were on with Dave Simonette because you're training, you've trained two of his dogs.
Yep, Herbeck, and then we did Maxon for him, yep.
Yeah, and I was on a South Dakota hunt with Herbeck, and that dog is an absolute... just incredible retriever. You've done an amazing job with it. Because I remember, so let's go down that story just for a moment. Because Dave heard me and Billy Hildebrand talking with Tom Dockin, who you work for, owns Dockin's Kennels, and heard us talking about, you know, have you ever trained a dog that wasn't like a lab or a short hair? And Simonette heard that. He's like, boy, I wonder if they can train Herbeck. And that project landed in your lap.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, when he came in, it was like, you know, the best thing about that with having a breed that he was unsure of, he kind of went into that with like, hey, I don't know if this is going to happen. Would you be willing to give it a try? And our motto here is, you know, I mean, if it has fur on it, we're going to try to train it. So it was like he came in with going, if you can do this, great. If not, and that was kind of the best way for him to have his mindset in, because it came in, and honestly, I think that's why the stars aligned, because he didn't put the pressure on himself for that dog. And, you know, when dogs come into these programs, one we're going to really be talking about with your new pup today, with that bird and gun introduction, giving that dog an opportunity to go on live birds and bring out that prey drive, if it's in there, that's a process going to do that. And we got lucky with that dog. That prey drive was there, and that program brought it out. And, you know, how many years later now, that dog is on trip after trip, hunting birds, and, you know, just amazing story on that dog.
Yeah, when you look at Herbeck, I don't know, I always think German Shepherd.
Right? Definitely, yep.
And I've witnessed that dog most recently in South Dakota tracked down a crippled rooster like 150 yards, no lie,
right,
and just outrun every other dog in the field and bring back that rooster to David. Talk about a proud moment. You know, he could play Red Rocks or the XL Energy Center, but when Herbeck brings back a rooster, that, you know, the chest puffs out, and rightfully so, because that dog is awesome.
That was a great story. And then, you know, that followed up with another dog, and you know, he actually went down the road of, you know, researching, buying a dog from a breeder, and really targeted something that he felt was came from bird lines. And, you know, that dog went through the same process, and, you know, it's been just a great story that, you know, we got him a couple great hunting dogs, and they're family dogs first and hunting dogs second. But, you know, that's been a fun journey with those guys. And, you know, it's just so rewarding as a dog trainer to, you know, give that gift to somebody, especially when they bring a dog that they don't even know if there's any genetics to hunt at all. So that's fun.
Well, and I mentioned, you know, we've been on a number of times together, talked about Gitche, my, who's now five. And you did wonders with Gitche, who, you know, I had gotten to a point at 2 years of age where she was a pretty good pointer, but her retrieve was kind of sucky. And now I'm a proud papa, and I sing your praises every time she brings a bird back to my right knee. She's just had an awesome season. So sincerest thank you for the work you did.
That was, you know, and that was a dog that had all the ingredients. She just needed some help on her retrieve to hand, and that train to retrieve was just a process that she needed to fill in that part that she was missing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like you mentioned, we're going to talk about bird and gun introduction, and I'm hopeful that this episode will live for years on the Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever website, because every year people are asking, well, how do I properly go about introducing my gun, my puppy properly to birds and guns. So we're going to talk about that. Before we go there, just for folks that maybe haven't heard you on the podcast before, give the Mike Wieben story to them.
Okay, well, you know, I started as a young kid out of high school. I'm a farm kid, didn't know nothing about dog training. Came down here, seen a dog running out of a boat. I was a duck hunter as a kid, a little bit of pheasant hunting. My friends got me into duck hunting, and I was addicted immediately. Well, these were dogs that were untrained, didn't have any control. And when I showed up here and seen a dog do it in the boat, decoys, retrieve the duck, deliver it to hand, my eyes were just, and my jaw dropped. I was like, this happens? Yeah. This is an achievable thing with a dog? And I was hooked. And I'm an outdoor, I was a hunter, a fisherman, I'm a farm kid, I've been outside my whole life, and I looked at it like, how do I get on board with this? Wow. Well, let's fast forward 23, 24 years now. I've gone through the process here with Tom. He lays out, instead of going to college, I went to dog training college, and I got put in a position to start at the bottom of the totem pole. And you really, as to be a dog trainer, it's kind of the best way to go about it, starting with helping cleaning kennels, handling young dogs, doing the chores, being around this environment. And then it led to that eagerness to want more. I mean, once you got one thing, it's like, all right, what's next? And I've had an opportunity to go through the process of learning this bird and gun introduction was one of the first things, training obedience. One of the hardest things to train somebody to do would be the retrieve to hand. We're going to talk a little bit about that, I imagine, too. But that takes some time. And as Tom looked at me as an eager kid wanting to learn, the part of being a dog trainer is kind of making sure somebody's really willing to go that route with you, because if you're going to put all the effort into training somebody to do these things, you know, and like for us, we're always looking for those next young kids that are outdoor kids, dog people, and maybe looking to go down this road. But it's kind of starting at that bottom level and seeing if they're really dedicated to wanting to live this lifestyle and be in this industry. Once again, I was one of those kids. I could not get enough of it and just took time. So it was about a four-year process, is about what it takes to kind of be around dogs, start training dogs, being overseen by the senior staff. Then you start branching off a little bit, kind of with them watching on the sidelines. And then it becomes the point where you kind of have those proud moments that I took this dog from start to finish. Mm-hmm. I got to bring Tom in and go, okay, show him the finished product. Now, I'll be honest, they selected kind of the better dogs, you know, for you to build your confidence, right? And then you get good with them, and then it's like, all right, now we got to take some that are not as easier to train. And that's really, I felt, where the learning came in to really make me a dog trainer, because training the easier ones, that was great. But when you can learn to train the ones that don't just hand it to you, I think that's what really starts to develop, where you have more tools in your toolbox to shift gears. Because as we always say, every dog's different. I mean, you're on multiple dogs, and we're already been talking here about this dog about, it actually comes from some of the lines of the dogs you've had. And there's differences.
There's subtle differences.
So over the years, I just kind of got a passion for this. And now being under Tom Dawkins' wing for so many years, I've been very blessed that I've had him as a mentor, somebody to talk to, and a guy that's been doing this for his whole life. Mm-hmm. So when something came up, I mean, I've always felt like I had the best experience to talk to, get some feedback. But the good thing about him is he never handed it and went, here, just let me show you and I'll take over. He put me through the process of like, I'm going to work you through this, but you're going to do this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, God bless him. That was the best thing I needed. And it's really developed in from a trainer. And now for quite a few years now, I've been, you know, what I call his head trainer here at the facility, running the facility for him. And that's been a proud moment for me. And I hope to take on this legacy, you know, for another 50 years.
Yeah, so. Well, you have a dyed-in-the-wool believer in me. You've done a phenomenal job. And, you know, it's interesting. you also, like, Tom is one of the most well-spoken dog trainer. We have him on KFAN all the time. And you're not related, but the apple didn't fall far from the tree there either. Because
I get that once in a while. Right? Are you Tom's son? Well, pretty much. But no.
But that's important too, mm-hmm. right? Communication, being able to explain to the dog's owners mm-hmm. what's going on, how to continue what you established here so it doesn't just fall off the table at home. Well, that's an incredibly important component, isn't it?
And that goes back to, like, the learning of being a dog trainer. So that's why there's a four-year minimum part. You got to learn to train the dog. Now there's a whole nother element of training the customer. And just like there's different dogs, there's different people. Mm-hmm. People have been brought up in different environments with their family dogs, buddies' dogs. And it takes a while to kind of navigate how to take all different personalities of people and dogs and kind of get to the ending goal. And clients from all of backgrounds, you know, way they were brought up, what their grandpa did, what their dad did, all has kind of a wavering factor on when you're working with them. But it's finding common ground with everybody. Huh. And it's been a really fun thing to open maybe customers' eyes to certain things. Like, well, you know, I never thought of it that way. But now that you explained it that way, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You know, so that part's been a very interesting ride in learning how to communicate with people. And that way they can maintain that dog's training after you put all that work into it.
You know, I'm taking a left turn a little bit here, but you started talking about, you know, as a young kid, this kind of hooked you. You know, it's like, boy, this is what I want to do the rest of my life. And, you know, bringing in other young men and women here to work, I've seen it. You know, in the summer in particular, a mm-hmm. lot of high school kids, I'm assuming, are working.
Yep.
We have a program at Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever called Journey to Conservation Careers. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, there's a decline in people that want to be biologists and get involved in conservation. And so we're trying to boost up that interest amongst college age kids and connect it to hunting too. Mm-hmm. So they understand, you know, the conservation component of hunting and how habitat connects to, you know, wildlife and water quality. And so where a long-winded question is, where I'm leading is, have you seen more, less, or stable number of kids interested in working for a kennel and working with you in dog training? What's kind of the state of the state on dog training, interested as a career?
When I started, it seemed like there was kids lined up at the door to try to be involved, you know, doing some work outdoors. I mean, I've seen over the years, it seems like that's kind of gone down, right? Yeah, less interest in the outdoors, maybe more in the house, whether it was the computers or the gaming or, you know, just things sports related, which that's great. But yeah, definitely have seen a decline in interest in that. You know, we got a great staff. We're still always been stable with our help here, especially we have, like you mentioned, a lot of high school kids. Like, we have kids here right now are working, coming after school, love dogs, love everything about it. But yeah, the applications used to be stacked up, and now it is definitely declined, I would say. So I'm hoping either anybody that hears this podcast, whether it's on your end or my end, we can hopefully get more kids into the outdoors. And you know, this dog thing is, you know, it's an industry thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not only a dog trainer, but everybody I communicate with is a hunter, a fisherman, you know, a dog lover, all these things. So it's been a very rewarding job because it really relates to everything I do outside of work as well.
So if there is a, you know, say a 12-year-old or a high schooler listening and thinking, I do want to be a dog trainer when I grow up, would the best bit of advice be to contact a local trainer and
Absolutely.
Say, I want a summer gig?
That's right. And most trainers are going to do what we do similar is, like, you can't just throw them in a position to be responsible for training. So our job here is, like, we have what we call kennel staff, kennel crew. They're helping walking, feeding, cleaning the kennels. They're just here, and they're taking in on what's going on. Some kids like to just be in that category. They like a part-time job with that. And then some kids like, hey, I want more, guys and girls. And then we have what's called a trainer's assistant position. Mm-hmm. Now you're starting to handle the puppies. You're starting to help birdie them up. You're helping gather the birds and get them ready. And you're throwing mark retrieves for the trainers, maybe on land. Maybe you're sitting in a boat in the water. And you take that time to watch what trainers are doing mm-hmm. before you're actually responsible for it. And you get to see enough group of dogs go from start to finish, and you take that all in. And then you kind of go, all right, that's usually when the kids, like me, went, no, what's next? What's next?
Yeah.
Get me in there, coach.
Yeah.
And that's where kids kind of decide. And then some of our kids will kind of work for us for the summer. They have college plans. Mm-hmm. That's great. I tell them, if you need anything, referrals, let me know. Mm-hmm. I'll give you one. And then we have some kids that go, you know, I don't really want to go spend $100,000 on this, that, and the other. I want to maybe have something in a trade, kind of like dog training.
Huh.
And then that's where the blessing for me is going through it is I got paid a wage for working and got learning all at the same time.
Yep.
So instead of going out of dog training with a big school debt, yes, I was paid accordingly to where I was, but all that knowledge I got through that process, I mean, they paid me to learn how to be a dog trainer. Mm-hmm. So Tom has really set up not only a training dog situation, but to train. And he's had over the years, you know, guys that have trained for him.
Yeah.
There's guys that are like me that are still here, and there's guys out there that have taken his model and what he's done, and now they own their own successful business. And, you know, that just goes to show that process works.
Yeah, it's like a coaching tree.
Right? It really is.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, that's awesome. So if you are listening and you're interested, you know, hit up your local trainer and see if you can find a summer gig or I'm sure you need help in the winter
too. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's a great opportunity. On the Wing podcast is fueled by Purina Pro Plan, and I'm proud to recognize Purina Pro Plan as the national dog food sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. They contribute to our wildlife habitat mission and are the presenting sponsor of On the Wing podcast. All three of my pups, Esky, Gitchy, and Winter, who we're going to talk about here in a moment, all eat Purina Pro Plan, not just because Purina supports the wildlife habitat conservation mission, so important to me, but Purina Pro Plan also has the world's best scientists and nutritionists behind their bird dogs and the food that they make for their bird dogs. Learn more at ProPlanSport.com, Purina Pro Plan Nutrition that performs. All right, so Winter. I haven't talked much about Winter my podcast.
Yeah, this is a new one, yep.
Winter's a five-month-old pup that I brought to Dawkins Oak Ridge Kennel to Mike 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she's had very limited bird contact at this point. Probably at 3 months, she met a pigeon on a string, and then a bobwhite quail, and then hunting season started, and rooster road trip,
sure.
And I was traveling from North Dakota to South Dakota, and you know what? This is the first pup that I'd ever gotten during hunting season.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, I've gotten my puppies in the spring, so I have the entire summer to work towards hunting season while they're not great hunters in their first year. They're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case with Winter. She was too young.
Yeah.
And time got away from me, and I called my buddy Mike up, and I said, I need your help.
Yeah, we need a gun break one here.
We need bird and gun introduction. So let's start there. Like bird and in gun introduction, and I'm sure let's start with the gun shy piece of it. I'm sure you've heard horror stories over the years.
Yep.
That's probably the most
unreversible problem.
So that's what I've heard.
Yeah.
Most unreversible. So what's the worst story you've heard about gun shy?
Well,
like how somebody, because people have, like, I've heard the, well, you just put your pup in the kennel, their safe place, go to the, you know, put in the truck and then drive to the clay range and the dog will feel safe, but hear all the gunfire. I'm sure you've heard something
sure.
like that. You know, the unplanned go to the 4th of July fireworks And that probably creates more gun-shy dogs than anything, is
that's
my
a lot.
Guess.
That's a lot.
Well, yep. What's the worst story you've heard?
Well, I think some of the worst ones, you know, fireworks have really changed, too. I mean, I'm old enough to know that it used to not be these big mortars in town. I mean, fireworks have really become more available, and let's touch about that. Like, there's more of those cases now.
Back more gun-shy cases because of fireworks?
Okay. It used to be bottle rockets and a few black cats.
Sparklers.
Sure, nothing. So now these people are letting off in town these mortars and these things that are very loud and extreme.
You're right. Yep.
And even metro people now maybe didn't go to the fireworks, but the fireworks are coming to them, right? So people are learning now, or hopefully on this podcast we can talk about, like, when it's that time of year, you need to be protecting that dog in the house, in a kennel, not by the windows, maybe a blanket over their kennel, maybe a radio going or the TV so loud to drown out that situation.
Yeah.
Because I think those fireworks are coming. Like, I don't know how many people's like, yeah, it's my neighbor across the road was setting off fireworks. We didn't even go to the fireworks. It came to us.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's been another one that's really grown as the storyline of a gun-shy dog. Back in the day, it was more of, well, we kind of weren't thinking, and we were sighting in our shotguns or our rifles for deer hunting, or we're going to go out and shoot the pistols, and we just, you know, weren't thinking. The dog was just running around outside like it always is, and we shot, and that dog took off, and we think we have a problem. Going back years ago, I mean, dog training, you know, if Tom could even say, like, it used to be you did the gun first. Is the dog okay with the noise? Okay. Yep, the dog's okay with the gun. Now let's go see if the dog will get on birds. You know, and this goes back years, and I still have people, even now, that's what their grandpa did. That's what they did when they were a kid. Like, that's what, and it worked. And the problem is that worked out sometimes. So there's enough stories out there. That's exactly what I did. I just took the dog out hunting and shot it. It was fine. Hunted its whole life. But when you're a dog trainer, you get all the stories of something that went wrong and what do I do? So I'd say the worst has been really these days would be fireworks is getting high on the list now because of the world changing. And then just the people, you know, maybe not thinking about when they're shooting those guns around the house. And then the other one would probably be that they just thought the right thing to do was to take the dog out and start shooting, or like you mentioned, the clay pigeon thing. So we're different in the sense of the narrative of what we want to make sure people understand is what we try to do here at every dog that comes to Bird and Gun, including yours that just got dropped off and now picked up, it was the gun was not the first move. We would have started with some dead birds. Okay, some dogs will jump, pick up a dead bird. Some dogs need a live bird to engage in their retrieving. Or in your dog's case, we weren't... And so everybody knows your dog is a pointing breed.
Yep, it's a short hair.
Short hair. So
big surprise to listeners.
Yes. The retrieve was not the strong thing right away. Chasing it, and even for us, we weren't getting pickup right away, but that dog was very intrigued with chasing a bird. So before there was any gun work, we were working on chasing live pigeons, getting that dog focused and locked in on that chase. Then our first noise would have been, and this is to anybody that's doing them themselves or wondering how this process is done, our wording is let's get the dog 100% focused on a bird, handling a bird, or even in a dog like a pointer that there's some pointers that don't retrieve at all. I've trained pointers that I've gun broke them only on them chasing the bird. But I've evaluated that the dog is engaged, chasing enough, and locked into chasing that bird that I – gives me permission to start working on some noise. Now, by doing that, we have the dog focused on the bird, but now it's not going right to a 12 gauge. We will take a step before any guns are fired, and we will take our leather gloves, and we'll throw a retrieve, and we'll clap. Now, most dogs have had their owners excitable clap, praising the dog clap, so that's kind of should be a somewhat of a familiar correlation of sound. So we got the dog focused on birds. Now we're going to start testing. We're going to bring a little noise in. Okay, we did a hand clap. That's usually not one that startles a dog. Even a dog that we've had come in that has maybe goes, hey, I'm worried that my dog's gun shy. there was this fireworks thing, then we did this, we did. Okay, the hand clap is usually never an issue. It's when we start taking a 209, you know, some people would start, even start with like a 209 primer. We go even lower. We go to a 22 blank. Now, there's different kind of 22s. There is ones that go in like a dummy launcher that are kind of a long 22.
Yep.
We use what's called an acorn 22 blank. Really small, real light. It's the smallest 22 that we have.
So it's like a cap gun.
It's a little bit more, but very close.
Okay.
Where that long 22 is going to give way more of a crack compared to just a popping sound.
Okay.
We take that starter pistol and actually muffle it by putting it in a carpet square where I can clap my hands louder with leather gloves than that starter pistol going off in that pouch. Now, every retrieve, that dog is getting a fresh live bird. Let's say you have a dog, we'll use Gitch for a minute. If you threw a live bird for her, she would kill it. Remember back
hard
in the
mouth,
day? Hard mouth. When we're gun breaking, even a young puppy at 5-6 months of age, if that dog kills the bird on the first retrieve, we go. There's another live bird. When we're working through that gun work, we want a live, active bird. So that's the beauty of going to a dog trainer that has unlimited access to birds. Every retrieve could potentially be a dog that kills it. We're not just going to keep throwing the dead bird.
So, because you're trying to build up the prey drive and the excitement?
I want that excitement to be so at its highest level as I start adding some noise conditioning in.
Gotcha. Okay.
Now, if you can start moving ahead on the gun and that bird loses its excitement, that opens the door.
The dog loses the excitement on the bird.
Yes. Okay. Right? So the bird's not alive anymore.
Yeah.
That opens up the dog to go, well, what was that noise?
Okay.
Compared to your dog is so excited to grab that live bird. Okay, hand clap. That went good. Starter pistol in a muffled pouch. Slowly adding more. And what this program paired to gun breaking your dog yourself, if you ever do this, it's 2-on-1. One person has to hold the dog back far enough so the other person can get the gun and bird out in front of the dog. And I know on some of these podcasts we've talked a little bit about gun breaking and birding gun introduction, but to kind of go down the process, when I throw the bird, I already know the dog wants the bird. We've checked that box. I throw the bird, I clap, or I start shooting the blank gun. I'm watching that dog's eyes to looking and taking its eyes off the bird. I've seen dogs twitch their ear, blink, a look, a pause. All those could be a sign that, whoa, 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 that dog took its focus off the bird and it was focusing on the noise. That's enough to go, we need to back up. We need to go back to hand clap. If we've gone from the blank gun to the 410, and that's usually where dogs, if they have gun shy concern or noise sensitivity, you're out, guy was getting a load of gravel and the tailgate slammed. You didn't think nothing of it, but that spooked the dog. Now that dog is cautious of loud noises. We're looking for anything that takes the dog off the bird to be a warning sign that we might need to slow down or back up. Now, you take that same dog and you go and just shoot a 12-gauge, right? You had no chance to slow that down and figure out if this dog has any concern with noise. I'll see dogs that I've seen a blink or a look, and I don't take that as like, oh, that's fine. I go back and go, all right, we're going to take a step back, review where we came from, and I've seen a dog blink once or look at me, and we backed up, moved forward. I was like, well, that wasn't nothing. But I took that blink or that look very seriously.
Yeah, you're just validating that that was an anomaly and that the bird drive is purely there to override any disinterest caused by the shot.
Now you're starting to get a dog after. So let's go through your dog's 2-week bird and gun.
Yeah.
Got dropped off on a Friday or Saturday. Monday morning, live birds, hand clap. That went good. Tuesday, starting to shoot that starter pistol in a muffled pouch, trying to bring it out throughout the day on Tuesday. Wednesday, we're hoping that we can start shooting that blank gun outside of the pouch. Multiple shooting on Thursday, moving into blank gun 410 on Friday. But in that first week, that one's the most crucial. And that's where we're looking for those things of, oh, that dog showed some sensitivity. it did something where we might need to back up. And normally if a dog had a bad experience with guns, fireworks, it's usually not the hand clap. It's once you bring that starter pistol out of that muffled pouch and that full pop of the gun happens, even when it's a .22 Acorn blank. Generally, if there's a gun-shy issue, I've seen dogs, I got them picking up birds, I've hand clapped, I did the muffled pouch, and once I fully brought that blank gun out, that dog ran to the bird, they heard that noise, and it was a dead stop.
Hmm.
And that dog goes, nope, I'm out.
Hmm.
So that's where, in the old days, when a dog was done the gun first before bird, how many of those good dogs that never had a chance to show themselves on birds, things were already ruined before they even had a chance to be a bird dog? And then I've had many bird dogs come in that were gun shy, and it's just a damn shame because you'll throw a bird and it's like that dog. I mean, and of course, that's the dog that picks it up perfect, brings it back to you perfect, no monkeying around, hands it it's like this is a dream.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, something negative happened to set that dog up to be concerned.
What percentage of dogs are you able to reverse gun shyness?
I've been doing this for over 20 years. I've had a couple, but I will say the dog tolerated the noise because it wanted the bird bad enough.
Wow.
It still didn't like it. And that most of those people would say if there's thunder, lightning, fireworks, if it isn't in that hunting scenario, that dog is in the corner shaking. So that dog just eventually went, you know what? I want that bird bad enough that I'm willing to put up with that. But we're always trying to tell people like, hey, like your dog, 2 weeks, let's take it slow. Let's watch for things that may be a problem where we can back up and not rush this dog through this process. Make birds first. Now what we're trying to do is go, all right, the dog starts hearing the hand clap, the starter pistol, but it's starting to associate, hey, every time I get a bird, I hear a little noise, but it means I get this thing. And I'm chasing it, and it's alive. And using that clip wing pigeon to start off with, it's basically simulating a wounded bird. That dog's chasing it, getting some prey drive, as you mentioned, built. So you're doing two things. You're actually working that bird into helping you gun break the dog, but you're also preparing that dog for a crippled bird, the confidence of handling a live bird. So you're kind of getting a couple things done there. But then we go from that blank pistol, multiple shooting, 410 at a distance, closer, 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 then multiple shooting, repeat with the 20, repeat with the 12. So now all of this has been done where the gun has been out in front of the dog.
Okay.
Then there's still one more layer that we have to put down.
The gun is, so the somebody with the dog is holding the dog at a with a check cord.
Check cord back.
And you with the gun is out in front so the dog can see both the bird and the gun.
Yep, so they can see where the gun, the noise is coming from.
Okay.
And there's even a little training when you start with 410 from the blank gun, seeing that long gun, right? Being aware of there's something in your hand.
Yeah.
We want that dog to be able to see all that, who it's coming from. When you throw a bird, what I'm doing is when I throw a bird, I'm throwing a clip wing. So I don't have to watch where the bird's going. I'm throwing the bird, shooting the gun away from the dog. My eyes are on the dog the whole time. Now I've got the dog 410, 20 gauge, 12 gauge, all of them with single to multiple shots out front. Now that last layer then is when you start going to flush and kill. Now the dog had, let's just use a lab for example, had flushed the bird. Well, where's the dog in correlation to the gun now? Now you're behind the dog.
Right.
So you want to do extra training in front to ensure that that dog is very comfortable with that scenario. Because now the last step then is that firearm gets moved behind the dog. Well, when you're in front of the dog, the muzzle is taking more of that sound further away from the dog. Once you go behind, now all that noise intensifies going over the top of the dog.
Okay.
So that's why there's a lot of work done in front before you actually...
That's interesting because I had always thought about it being done with the bird in front of the dog, but the gun behind somewhere else, so the dog's focus is completely on the bird and the shot is sort of a periphery. And you're talking about putting them in front so the dog actually associates them together.
Together. And then by shooting in, you know, if you're in front and you're shooting forward, you're taking that muzzle blast and
right,
sending
the sound
it
is beyond.
And we're also in an environment where if anybody's ever shot, whether it's duck hunting or pheasant hunting, and they've been in a wooded area, grouse hunting, like that echoes that sound and you get that repeat of the shot.
Yeah.
We're in a field that's very open.
Yep.
And we, even in our area here, we have woods in the distance. I will purposely make sure I find an area to shoot the gun in the most open environment so that sound can carry away and not get that repeat off the wooded lot next door. Because that could also be like the dog heard the shot and then it repeated over there in the neighbor's woods. And now the dog's focus is over there. So there's every caution is done to make sure that there's nothing can go wrong in this two-week program.
You talked about if a dog, a young pup, has had an experience where they're a little bit gun-shy, let's say the fireworks, you see that when you immediately go to the Acorn 22, right?
Yep.
Like, all of a sudden, that's enough sound to cause an alarm. What about pup that has never had a bad experience, but you're going through this progression, Acorn 22 to a regular 22 or long 22, is that the
nope, it would just be from the Acorn to the 410.
Okay, the 410, 28, 20, 12.
Yep.
Is there a predictable place in that progression that you have to be significantly concerned about where there's a big enough jump in sound where it's like, if we're going to have a problem, this is where I got to be.
I would say the blank gun from the hand clap is your big one.
Okay.
That's where you're really cautious. Blank gun to the 410 would probably be the next jump that you're most on edge, like crossing your fingers that this continues in the right direction. 410 to 20, there's a little bit there, but generally once you're on the 20 gauge, you're pretty confident that the 12 is not a big jump. Now, there's dogs, let's say you brought me a dog that you were worried or you've seen some sense of gun shyness. There is another thing we can add in between the 22 blank and the 410, which would be a 209 primer. Okay, so I've had dogs that have been brought in, they were worried about gun shyness, or if I seen a little hesitation, even if that wasn't the case, I was doing the Acorn blanks and I had a couple weird incidents. I'll take that dog, and then I'll even take, once I get the Acorn blanks, I'll even take a 209 primer. I might throw it back in that muffled pouch, bring it back out again before I go to that long gun. But most dogs that go through our program, including Winter that just did it, she went from the blank gun, single shots, multiple shots, and I'm talking like she's going by, and it's pop, 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 pop with that 22 blank Acorns. Then that 410, that made a big difference because that's more of that shotgun sound.
Yep.
We're out 50, 60 yards shooting in the open, moving that closer and closer. But I would say the first gun that you're probably the most cautious with is the blank gun.
Okay.
And that's why we put it in that muffled pouch so we can slow down the progression of that.
Are there breeds of dogs that you feel like you got to be more cautious with, or is it purely an individual dog by dog by dog?
100%. You know, across the board, different breeds. I would never say that in my experience that I've said, like, I've had more of this that are gun shy. It's always been, let's say, a human factor that's been put involved. Now, the only thing that would be a little bit different would be like a dog picking up a bird or not. You know, then there could be some genetics, right? Did the dog come from a hunting line? Did it not come from a hunting line? Did the dog get noed off chickens at home for the last 3 months, and now we're throwing a clip-wing bird? And the dog's going, well, I'm going to get in trouble if I go get that.
Right.
You know, so there are some of those cases. But I would not ever say that I've seen overall that there's, like, it's been this breed that's been the problem. It's been a little bit sprinkled all over of all the different breeds.
Is there anything, so you maybe you get a puppy for Christmas, right?
Sure.
Anything that sets you up properly? Like, so we talked about fireworks and avoiding loud noises and things like that. What about doing things to set the stage properly?
Yeah, so I think that's a great question because you get people tell me stories like, well, I was banging the pans when I fed the dog.
Right. I've heard that story.
Okay, well, what if that goes wrong, though? Mm-hmm. What if you startle that puppy? When they're that young, you don't know enough about what that dog's personality is. They're new in your home. Now, if you know how to evaluate dogs a little bit, you've had a lot, you're like, no, this dog's a freaking Tasmanian devil. I can see that there's nothing's going to phase this dog.
Mm-hmm.
You could probably do some of that, but those things still run the risk that if you do that and it backfires, and we go, well, and let's say you checked in winter, and you're like, well, I've never did gun. I never did fireworks. She's never been, but when she was a puppy, I banged some pans together.
Mm-hmm.
And then here's what we get told. Well, she was fine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you know she was fine? She might have been distracted because she wanted her food.
Mm-hmm.
But really inside, she was not really enjoying or she was uncomfortable with that. But she wanted her food bad enough. And that could set the stage to later on life. Now when she hears noise, you know, I don't think I really like that. So I feel that dogs are best to just avoid loud noises, guns, fireworks, gun, trap range. Let's put her first experience with gun noise in correlation with getting a prize.
Mm.
And I always say to people, it's like the live bird is like getting a $100 bill thrown for you all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I mentioned like every retrieve, no matter what that dog does, it gets a fresh bird. We want to be throwing $100 bills every retrieve to make sure we're giving that dog the best valued item as they're going through. Okay, this noise means I get that. So my own recommendation, my own personal dogs, I avoid all loud noises. Now, I understand when you live out in the world, you can't protect from unknown things,
sure,
right? They
right.
can happen. But at all costs, I really try to avoid until I get my dog gun broke. At all possible, try to keep them away from anything that might startle them. Now, there is dogs that we train that I'll honestly say you probably could have just took that dog out,
mm-hmm.
and you probably could have just shot a gun, and it would have been just fine.
Right. It happened through the 60s and the 70s, right? But you don't know how many dogs were gun-shy as a result of mm-hmm. that either.
Yeah, and I think the world's changed. You know, when you talk about that time frame, my grandpa or your grandpa might have said, well, that didn't work out, whatever. I'm just going to get a different dog.
Mm-hmm.
Now these dogs are family first. They are our children.
Mm-hmm.
They don't live outside in a kennel. They're not a tool. They are our family dog first. So I think we're really finding that if we can put ourselves in a good position to have that family dog be a hunting dog, let's take a step back and maybe get away from the old version and start to be a little more cautious here so we can have that family hunting dog. And I think the attitude was just a little bit different that if it didn't work out, well, there's more dogs out there. I think we all know once winter came home, winter's not going anywhere.
She's not leaving the Sapir household.
Yeah, so yeah. I think now since the world's changed, I think we need to do a better job of protecting these dogs from loud noise sensitivity, put them through a program. You know, any local trainer, you know, is going to give you a program, live birds. And I think that's important. Like if you try to do this on your own, you got to think about the list we've already talked. You got to have multiple different guns.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have a space to do this. When Winter started this 2-week program, it didn't stop. It's been nonstop mm-hmm. every single day from you dropped her off on a Friday, 2 weeks later, picking her up.
Mm-hmm.
And she literally got birds every single day she was here.
Mm-hmm.
When you gun break a dog and you do a couple days on a weekend, if you're going to do it that route, I would even caution you, we said we took 2 weeks every day. If you're going to be doing this on your own and you're going to be spacing things out, you might want to say it's going to take you a month,
mm-hmm.
maybe more. You're going to want to go back, re-review what you did, not assume what happened last Sunday. You can jump right on the following Sunday.
And, you know, we had talked, there were times where I like, you know, I'd like to bring her in now. And you're like, well, Bob, she's only 4 months old.
Mm-hmm.
5 months old is a big deal to you for a couple of reasons. Explain why.
Yeah, so number one would be maturity. It's usually a good time. But another big factor is teething, okay? Those adult canines, are normally those puppy teeth have mainly came out, the molars. The last ones to come in are generally those canines.
Mm.
When we start to try to gun break a dog, and if they're still in the middle of that teething part where their mouth is sensitive, they might not handle that live bird and take control of that live bird if that mouth is sore.
Mm.
So as you probably noticed, those puppy teeth have been just probably falling out prior
to... We found one in the house after we brought her here.
Okay. So yeah. That five-month mark is... They're mature enough to get started on the gun and bird, uh-huh. but we don't feel like they're mature enough to start the finishing process of pressure on, pressure off, working through control training. But they're mature enough to start having some fun. And the big thing with these young dogs is getting the gun and bird, and let's even take it one step down, getting their bird drive mm-hmm. going, get those juices flowing. You know, you take a dog, I'm just going to use an example. We'll get a dog that's a year old, maybe two. They come in for bird and gun introduction. If you haven't gotten that bird drive going, I'll just use a male. I'm going to throw a male dog under the bus for a minute. And that he comes out, he comes here, and he smells all this other dog smell. His mind is just like, I'm leaving my scent. I'm going to mm-hmm. figure out what other dogs have been here. And this goes for female dogs as well. But he doesn't want to focus on birds because that hasn't been opened up as a door. So getting that as young as possible. And then it also goes... After you picked her up today, what did we do? We sat down and went, okay, Bob, this is not your other dogs. Mm-hmm. Some similar things, but some things are different. Now we get a game plan to educate you between now and 8 to 10 months when we want to see your pup back, getting you a game plan, giving you things to do, maybe things not to do, maybe finding, you know, let's talk about bird and gun. One thing we see a lot of problem with is retrieving. So let's talk a lab for a second. That dog had a lot of toys and balls and things that maybe the dog had a great time with. And I'd also say to that same person, if it's not a hunting dog, like I'm not concerned of what you're giving the dog. But if we're going to give it a job to do and retrieve in the field, we're seeing a lot of these young dogs coming in and they shake the bird. Mm. They want to sit out and play with the bird. And we have these discussions with the owner like, well, yeah, that's what he does when we give him this toy or a squeaker toy or a plush toy. And, you know, that's really hard when these dogs have came in and been family first, right? Mm-hmm. They come home, how many toys can we give for the puppy? But I want to caution people that some of those toys can really have a bad influence then on the bird. And that young puppy can't see the difference of, well, I can do this at home with this toy compared to I can't do that with the bird.
Right.
Now it becomes all this training that we might have to do later to undo that habit. So that'd be some information I'd really like to spread out there, that using something that promotes a good retrieve. Now, I do work with Tom Dockin that makes the Dockin Deadfall Trainer. Mm-hmm. A lot of years of training and research that have gone into hard head, hard feet, grab the middle, right? Promoting the dog to grab something well.
Right, the head on a floppy string. I mean, it mimics a dead bird mm-hmm. being brought back.
Moving their mouth into the center. Mm-hmm. Filling their mouth. So that'd be the one thing I'd really say is when you have a young dog, trying to fill their mouth up with items that don't allow them to hard mouth and chew on things, because I promise you they're going to do it on the soft bird at some point. And then something that, like, you know, even like the docking, you know, if a puppy starts grabbing it by the rope,
yeah,
I'll cut the rope off.
Huh.
They grab it by the head, I'll cut the head off. So any of these dummies that have were... a knobby dummy, the dog can grab it like a cigar.
Yeah.
Or you see a dog grabbing it at the littlest thing. Well, we want to start moving that mouth to picking up the body of the bird. So really choosing some items that might help promote a good retrieve. And if you're seeing something, let's use a tennis ball, for example. I really find that the tennis ball is in the dog's mouth. They can squish it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's going to be chewing on a bird.
Mm-hmm.
It can be really hard for some dogs to get it from them because they have full control of that. That can also lead to a dropping and letting go problem. I've had guys say, hey, Mike, whether I like it or not, when I walk away, the grandkids or something's going to throw a ball. I said, well, how about this then? Let's throw a softball that fills that dog's mouth up, gives you more opportunity to get the drop.
Right.
If that's what it's got to be, let's at least go down this road.
Right. Well, you think about it, like how many plush imitation roosters and mallards are there in PetSmart?
Yep.
It's like by the dock in Deadfall, it looks like a rooster or a bobwhite quail or a rough grouse, but it simulates a bird, and you're actually doing yourself a solid by helping build in that proper retrieve.
Yeah, and Tom now has really took it to, we have one for 6 to 8 to 10 weeks. Mm. We've got our little mini ones now.
Mm.
We go up from the dove to the teal body, the wood duck to the mallard. You know, so there is really a size as your puppy progresses. Yeah. And I always say that to everybody. Like, I know it's hard for me to say. Of course, I work for the guy that makes these. But I look at it as, like, he was having problems with these things. And that's the way Tom works. What can I do to put the advantage of making a better retrieve by what I'm throwing?
Yeah.
And that's why that deck, Dock and Deadfall Trainer, has, you know, helped so many
dogs.
Yeah,
they're fabulous. The only downside is you could tear your rotator cuff throwing that Canada Goose.
Well, yeah, right.
Yep. But it serves the purpose, right? Absolutely. It'll fill up that that adult dog's mouth.
And that goose is really preparing a dog that the weight, the size, when they're appropriately ready for that. Mm-hmm. It's a great training tool to prepare that neck to pick up that mouth. Now, with the mallards and pheasants, you know, that's more of a center pickup.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that might be with a dog that's going to the goose, I want you to know that that balance point, I want you to grab your hand on there and keep moving it until you find that thing balance out. It's actually on the shoulder of that bird.
Mm.
Just like a wild one, that would be that balance point of picking up a bird. So with those geese, that bird pickup should actually be moved a little bit up towards the head compared to some of the smaller ones.
You know, the other thing about the 5 months that we talked about is it's also winter at all of our immunizations. She had all her vaccines by that point, too, and that's another big piece. Because she's been here at a kennel with a whole bunch of other dogs, and you want them to be healthy.
Yeah, and that's kind of that time frame that they normally get those lax, you know. So those big ones are rabies, distemper. And I'm glad you brought that up because rabies and distemper are kind of given to people without question. That's just normal protocol to going to the vet. The one that's missed a lot is called Bordetella, also known as kennel cough prevention. So that's like a human cold version in a dog. When dogs are at dog parks, out, you visiting other dogs, that is something that can be passed on from dog to dog. So this is an intranasal thing they do to boost their immune system. So when they're in a kennel or a boarding, if you're doing, you know, boarding or doggy daycare or any of those things, you find that that's a requirement from the state of Minnesota to have.
Okay.
And it is designed kind of like your kids get vaccinations to go to school. It's designed to protect them being around, you know, and here we're in our environment. We have dogs coming from all over the country, different locations. Somebody might have been out at a dog park yesterday playing with 10 other dogs, and then they come to our kennel to board. So those three vaccinations, and you're right, that timeline of 5 months. So that's why we hold off, as we talked earlier a few months ago. It's like 5 months is our window. So that's kind of the earliest that they have their teeth are put in, their vaccinations are all done, and a little bit of a good maturity point off to start that bird and gun program.
So I'll ask you for winter's report card.
Sure.
Before we go there, I want to thank Onyx, proud sponsor of Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever. So they support our wildlife habitat mission and our public access efforts. You can help too. Check out Onyx at the link to Onyx in the show notes, and you can get 20% off your Onyx subscription by using the code PFQF, and then Onyx will make a donation back to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's wildlife habitat mission and our public access efforts. So winter, now 5 months and 2 weeks old, how'd she do?
Well, I think she did amazing. I mean, on your part, you had her prepped a little bit. I think that was important. She was on some feathers. She knew what that was. She was socialized properly. So she came here, and, you know, I told you, right, if she jumps on me, I don't care. I want her to be able to bond with me.
Yeah.
So what we came to do was our main objective was make guns and birds good. Your dog is leaving this program. She's crazy about birds. She's been through the gun. She's showing that she knows that that sound means bird.
Did she hesitate at any of the progressions?
Mm-mm, didn't see anything. But at the same time, we set her up to succeed, right? We didn't put her in a bad position. Never seen a blink, a look, a hesitation, anything. And most dogs that don't have something go wrong prior to here, it's a recipe for success.
Great.
Okay? So she went through those process, no problems. Point, let's talk a little bit about point. We've seen a couple different varieties out of her. Putting the bird down, We've seen a couple where she pointed very well. Her natural point came out. And then we also seen her wanting to potentially sit on us. And we kind of chatted a little bit about that. So
don't give her treats in the kitchen and ask her to sit.
Okay, so let's talk about. So with these pointers, what we find, if they get taught to sit, and I would recommend anybody that has a pointer that's listening out there, that you're really working on standing and woeing. Until we get this dog gun broke on live birds, we want to keep that dog in a standing position, and we kind of talked about what can go wrong. So when at a young age, if they're taught to sit for a treat, sit for praise, sit for their food, whatever the case may be, now that dog's put in a position where it sees its prize, it wants to get it, we're helping them with the check cord stop and point, and they're like children. They're not patient. They want their prize right now. And we're trying to help them be a little bit more patient of holding the point and standing there, those dogs will start going, well, maybe if I sit, I'll get my prize a little faster.
Yeah. And I can, you know, you given her food, I know we've made that mistake and had her sit to get her food and with treats. Because the other dogs are capable of doing that, but as you also pointed out, our other dogs are capable or had progressed to a point where they know the difference.
Yeah, so if you can, we would ask you to hold off on sitting. And if a lot of guys are two things. They just didn't know, or they own labs or flushing dogs their whole life, and they went, you know what, I want to switch gears. I went out on a hunt out in South Dakota, and I seen some pointing dogs, and I loved every minute of that experience. I want to switch gears here. But they were brought up, but sit, sit, sit. So in our world of training, there's really only a couple things that get changed when it comes from a flushing dog to a pointing breed. One sits, one stands and woes, one points, and one flushes. But a lot of the other training we do is very similar. Basic obedience, walking on a leash, staying in range. But that difference of holding point per flushing. So I'm going to ask that everybody thinks about keeping their dog standing until we do bird and gun. Okay, so now we've got the dog pointing birds. They're not thinking that maybe if I sit, I'm going to get my treat or my reward quicker. Now, if you get a dog through training and let's say bird and gun, that dog is pointing so naturally that it's just right out of the box. Probably down the road, like you mentioned with your dogs, you can teach them to sit all you want because you know with the other two dogs, you take them, put them on birds.
They're going to point.
They're going to point. So I just want everybody to leave that one alone until we evaluate what kind of point you have. We're going to see some of that point in bird and gun. Now we can go, okay, yeah, point's there, but we need to build on this, shoot more birds and more birds, and then we might go, hey, we don't really need sit, or now that we have it established, sitting with the dog is not going to bring a bad effect into the field or in training.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's a big one. So with her, that was one area that we've discussed that we need to kind of divert now back to do what you were doing but replace sit with standing and woeing. Other than that, let's talk about her retrieve. She was a dog, which we see with pointers sometimes, that her chase was very strong. She was after that bird 100 miles an hour. But when she got to it, her instincts weren't pick this up and bring it to you. It was, I need to kill the bird. This is my bird, but I'm just going to stand out here and kind of guard that bird. And that's not uncommon with some pointers. It seems though you get a couple versions. Either pointers love to point and it's just amazing natural right out of the gate, and then sometimes there's no retrieve then. I mean, zero. They'll literally point, you shoot the bird, and they think that is where it all ends. They're off to hunt and find the next bird to point. Then we get, I'm going to talk about your dog. Your dog wanted to point. She wanted to get the bird, but there was nothing internally saying, I pick this up and bring it to somebody. Hence, pointer paired to a lab retriever.
Sure.
Just like I would never expect most labs just to point.
Right.
That's not. It happens, but it's not as common. What we found with her is with a lot of pointers that aren't really doing that, we also can see where they go, okay, I'm here at the bird, but I don't want you to have it. So we kind of use that in our advantage to go, she was standing over the bird, and we walked out to go, well, I'll take it from you. And what did that cause her to do? To pick up the bird, but she wasn't picking it up to retrieve to us. She was picking it up to avoid us having it. But now after 2 weeks, you kind of seen out of her first few birds. She got out there, but by us acting like we were going to take it enough times, she's going, well, I got to hurry up once I get there and take possession of this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she's still not running right to us. She's kind of taking her bird off, but now we're at least getting some sort of retrieve that we can build on.
Yeah.
The other pointer we see is just gangbusters to retrieve.
Mm.
What typically happens with those ones that really retrieve really well, though, is then when they have the opportunity to point, they don't want to point.
Mm.
Their brain is going, retrieve, retrieve, I got to get it.
Mm.
So those dogs will come in with a really nice retrieve, and then really the homework is finishing their point and using, we've talked in the past, controlled environment, check cord, and eventually a dog like that is probably going to be subject to what we call bird releasers, where that dog cannot get the bird without pointing. Because if you don't have control of the dog or in a potential training basket, that dog will just ram in and get the bird every time.
Yeah.
So overall, we're finishing her where we go, what was our main objective? Gun and bird. She's checked those boxes. Point, it's there. She had a little glitch with some sitting, but it's there. We've seen it today, like even with a little help, she went, well, okay, I get it. I got to stand to get my bird. We went from a retrieve that was almost non-existent to we're starting to get some shape on there. And talk about it was 2 weeks,
yeah,
right? So
yeah,
you're not asking them to finish a point perfect or retrieve.
Right, and she's 5 months old.
And she's 5 months old,
right?
But now we've done it at a young enough age that we can sit down with our customers and go, okay, this is what it's happening. We've been doing this long enough to know that based on what we're seeing, here's the best advice I can give you to what I think is going to be the results. But if we don't start the repetition now, I mean, anybody that's got a kid that they want to play football, I mean, kids are starting sports at a younger and younger age all the time.
Right.
Right. You're seeing kids playing tackle football and they're pretty young.
Yeah.
But it's getting them in that right as young as possible can really maybe set the stage to get them where we need to be as an older dog. But no discipline is going to be applied in our two-week bird and gun. This is not about heel, sit, lay down. There's no restrictions. If your dog jumps on me with muddy paws on a wet day, that's not why the dog's here. Mm. It's here to get guns and birds. And the rest of point and retrieve, it's more than an evaluation and helping them be the best they can be. And then we're going to be talking here the next step, and we'll probably have another follow-up of this with Winter. She's going to be going through our intermediate course at 8 months or older. And now we're going to be looking like we did with Gitch to look to finish her obedience, her collar conditioning, all her retrieving and pointing habits. Right now we're going to be just talking about you taking her home, setting her up for success. We've had a little discussion about game farm hunting. And let's touch on that if we have a minute.
Go for it.
Everybody's eager after bird and gun to go out.
I'm going hunting tomorrow, and my original plan was she was going to be in the field.
Sure. And here's the thing. When it's not hunting season, that pressure is not a conversation. Okay? But when it's – soon as October hits and it's pheasant opener, my radar goes off that when I get down with a customer after the demonstration, I know that conversation needs to be had because they're already going – and we're in hunting season, and you're not the only dog that went home today. Everybody was very excited to go out hunting tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
And I went, hold on. Where are you going? Well, we're going to got some public land here. Okay, well, have you scouted this? Is there birds? You think anybody else has been through there? Well, yeah. Have you scouted this? Are you seeing lots of birds in that environment? Well, I'm not sure. Okay. Even more importantly, we have a five-month-old dog, in your case, went through pigeons to chucker partridge, and now you're telling me we're going to put this five-month-old little dog on a wild rooster? Now, that wasn't your plan. You were going to go to a little smaller potential grouse, right, or woodcock.
Right. Well, woodcock's closed, but rough grouse was on my mind.
Okay. But then that person was like, you're going to go to the big old rooster?
Mm-hmm.
This dog's 5 months old. Well, you're pushing this way. You're going way ahead. You're getting the cart in front of the horse here.
So explain, because I immediately think of two reasons why that would potentially be damaging. One is roosters want to run, right? Mm-hmm. So with a pointer at 5 months old that is already showing some weakened signs on pointing, you're just going to perpetuate that with a running rooster. The other thing, you talked about pigeons, quail, chucker. Big old long spur could do some damage to a five-month-old puppy.
Yeah, and what has a wild bird done? It's survived out in the wild. Everything in the predator world has tried to kill and get that rooster. He's used to defending himself. That's why we've talked about, let's go to a game farm, let's control the environment, let's put out three or four birds.
Chuckers.
I always talk to people about chuckers. You know, pigeons really are the best bird to start any bird and gun program. They're a very docile bird. They have soft feathers. When you clip wing a pigeon, their defense is not their feet. They have real short feet, so they're not a runner. They only know how to really get out of there, and that is to fly. So once you've disabled that, that really puts that a really easy catch for a young dog. In our two-week bird and crumb, just like your dog, we did pigeons to get it going. Once we see a dog and talk about the grading of her, it's very good to see that she's moved from pigeons to chuckers. That told us that she was driven enough to handle the next step bird. You're adding a little more size. Now, a chucker is really, really good on his feet.
Runner.
They're a runner. They can go fast. So if you start a young dog off on a chucker that runs too fast, they might go, you know what, I can't catch this thing. I quit. So that's why the pigeon has always been the best bird to start. For years and years, I think every trainer out there would agree that that bird really helps get that dog in a good position. But if they can move forward, the chucker would be the next progression. So I would be asking my customer to go out to the game farm. And the thing about a chucker is, I think the most important is it's a covey bird. A pigeon that's out in the grass, if you put three or four birds out, a pigeon wakes up. If he sees an opportunity to get out of there, he's gone. Now, not only does the dog not get a bird, you've just spent money on the bird. Now you're both not winning. A pheasant, you mentioned, is going to run. Once again, not probably the great, even for a lab. You have the bird that comes there, the puppy's still a little unsure of what its nose means and what this in-the-field hunt is all about. It kind of smelt something. Now it's not trusting its nose. The bird has ran off. Once again, the dog doesn't get anything. You're not paying for you're paying for something you're not getting.
Right.
That chucker we find, even whether it's a pointing dog or a flushing dog, being that they covey down, when you dizzy up a bird for a flusher or tuck the head and put a pointing dog's bird to sleep for them, the chance of that bird is going to be there goes up. And my recommendation to everybody that goes to a game farm is I always say, hey, bring a little survey tape. Have them mark the birds for you. That way you can, you know, you get a big field that to shoot in, and you go, well, I don't know, the guy said he put them out here somewhere. You're going to feel pressure to have that dog, you know, cover every square inch of that field, paired to, I'm not saying just take the dog right to the ribbon that you see on the grass, but you're like, it's probably a good idea to head that direction, right? Make sure the wind's in your face. You're less chance of being surprised. You know, everybody's experienced that bird that exploded under their feet, and it takes you a minute to get your wits to actually pull the trigger and shoot. All that is taken out of there. Three or four birds, you know, especially on days if it's hot, you might limit that down to only a couple birds. But now in your case, we're going the other direction. We're going to cooler months. But if you put 10 birds out, now you might have three or four winter pointed them, retrieved them, made some amazing long retrieves. But you're going, God, we're five birds in, and she really could use a break. She's winded after all those long hunts and retrieves there.
Right.
But you're going, but I got to keep going.
I paid for
it. I got to get them. So I'd recommend a perfect idea would be getting, let's say, your 9 or 10 birds. If you're comfortable doing it, putting them out one or two or three at a time. I'd like to use the word three. Let's shoot three birds, take a break, evaluate how did that go, what changes could we make. Finding the good spots to put the bird where the wind is not in a low spot, maybe some high ground. You're seeing, oh, there's the grass moving really good. I got the wind in my face. Shooting three or four birds, pulling that dog out, taking a break. So now all of us would love to go shoot birds every single day if we could.
Right.
I'm unfortunate I get to do that a lot.
Yeah.
But if you took her out and shot 10 birds and some went well, and then all of a sudden she's kind of tired to the last few, compared to you did three, put her up, rested her, half an hour, sat there, just let her calm down, put three birds out again. Now, what did that turn that one day a month that you can get to the game farm? If you did three, three, and three, you just did three brand new hunts with that puppy. Pulling them out of the field, wanting more, not wearing them out to the point where they're like, they're laying down, huffing and puffing, and they kind of want to quit.
Right. Three sessions with a break in between to make it feel like three different days. The other piece to that that you've talked about being important is having a partner with you, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially for these pointing dogs. You know, you need somebody to run the rope for point and retrieve potentially. And it's good to have somebody that can maybe take the pressure of, you have a gun, you have a check cord, trying to navigate all those things to make it a good shot for this puppy. Having somebody come with you that you know is pretty confident in shooting, now you can run that dog. Now, if you have a flushing dog, you can get away with that a little bit more. Maybe just let, you're going to lose a little control of the check cord, maybe letting the flushing dog run off a little bit, but you can maybe manage that a little bit with one person. I'm always a big advocate of having two.
Mm-hmm.
One person's on the dog, one person's responsibility to shoot the bird. But with these pointing dogs, it's almost has to be two people.
Yeah, because I think about the check cord, there's really two big responsibilities, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, but the first is trying to ensure that the dog does point that bird, even if it's a flash point mm-hmm. with a young pup, that there's a hesitation to stop there, and the check cord can reinforce that.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing, which is the issue that you warned me about with Gitche, your partner makes the shot. The check cord when Gitche when Winter goes to get the bird, the check cord reinforces that she will bring it to me mm-hmm. as opposed to running off into the other field. And we've all witnessed those circumstances where they can be infuriating,
mm-hmm.
right? And a person who's not a pro trainer can lose their patience and completely go sideways on an experience that's supposed to be a positive for the dog.
Well, I'll say this. You threw the word pro trainer out there. I'm a pro trainer, and I have multiple other ones here. But when I go shoot for pointers, until they're collar conditioned and through our intermediate program, it's still a two-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
I want to maximize the best point and retrieve, and I want to have somebody in position to take care of handling that part, and I want somebody else doing the gun. Because even as a professional dog trainer, I find trying to manage both pieces, it can be done,
mm-hmm.
but you're opening the opportunity that, well, I was shooting and I didn't have the rope, and now this happened.
Yeah.
So really with the pointers, a two-on-one is really the best. Now, our bird and gun program, all dogs are done two-on-one, labs, retrievers of any kind, pointers, it don't matter. Because you got to have somebody to get the gun out and watch those, as we said, out front. But when it comes into intermediate program, I've taken some flushing dogs out and shot on my own and let the cord just go. But if that puppy started taking off on me and it's flushing birds 300 feet in front of me, well, then I got to go, all right, I got to get another person out here.
Mm-hmm.
So for our average person doing this, go into the game farm, take some pressure off yourself. Don't try to manage both sides. We can have a more safer environment too, because when you got a rope wrapped around you and the gun, if one person's away from that and can do that, you'll probably have a better opportunity to get the bird and, let's say, a more relaxing experience out there.
So as we wind towards the end, thanks Sport Dog again for sponsoring this particular episode. And, Sport Dog is sponsoring a bird dog training episode, and listeners are like, well, you guys haven't talked e-collars at all.
Sure.
And that's all right. Sport Dog wants to support the training of bird dogs, and this is an important step, and there is no e-collar component yet, right?
That's right.
Everything that's happened to this point has been done with a check cord.
Mm-hmm.
And that's deliberate.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah, everything's done manually. So let's talk about sport dog collars. Everything that's educated with a remote collar with a dog in any program is all done manually with a check cord or a 6-foot leash. And in the world of collars, I think what we've really tried to change the narrative is like the dog has to be manually shown. And the collar is just an overlay of what has already been educated manually with a check cord or a leash. And I think that's where the collars or the stigmatism of collars are bad. Mm. Well, they can be if they're not taught properly. The dog doesn't go through the steps of being manually shown. So this bird and gun program was all manually, but we are going to be using that check cord then to eventually overlay our remote collar training.
And listeners know that that's a tease in the radio business and podcasting. So the next episode we'll do together is when I bring Winter back.
Sure.
For the next step. And part of that next step will be overlaying the e-collar and reinforcing all the work that, all the homework I have for me in between now and when she turns 8, 9 months.
Yeah, absolutely.
Anything we missed? Anything you want to highlight during, you know, the bird and gun introduction? One question before I ask you anything we missed. People are listening and thinking about, you know, I live in Oklahoma, I live in California, and I want to take my puppy to bird and gun introduction. Any question or questions that they should be asking a pro trainer like yourself that would be valuable?
Yeah, I think the big question would be is, you know, how long is your program? I think this should be at least a couple weeks, a little longer. Some trainers will take, you know, a little longer. I wouldn't be if they say, hey, my program's 3 weeks. We found in our world that 2 weeks has been a good number to get what we want. What's the program look like? What kind of birds you have? You know, and you've kind of thrown out, you know, quail in here too. Now, quail can be used a little bit at a younger age, but then when the dogs get a little older, sometimes quail can be too soft.
Yeah, and too small.
And too small for some dogs.
Some dogs will try to swallow them whole. The other thing that I've experienced with quail in a game farm situation, they don't always fly real great, which can create a challenge for a pup too.
Yeah, so
at least game farm quail. Sure. Wild quail, different story.
Different story. So I'd be asking to make sure that they have, you know, access to birds, you know, making sure like their description is like, hey, we go through kind of the steps we talked about, that we go through pigeons and chuckers and we go through these gun steps. Those would be the big questions that I'd be asking. You know, most of the bird and gun, like I said, is not a lot of obedience or other things. It's in our world, I would kind of say it's Camp Snoopy for 2 weeks. It's fun. So just getting that vibe that they're going to take that gun nice and slow. That would probably be my biggest. They have the dog on live birds, and that they're at least a 2-week program. So that'd be kind of my criteria as you're searching out there for somebody to help you.
You know, folks are sometimes nervous or anxious talking about pricing.
Sure.
What's a reasonable price ballpark for this sort of?
You know, for
prices?
Us right now, for a 2-week program, you're looking at about a $600 value. You know, as things go up, bird costs go up, feed price.
Because that includes the birds, the food, the boarding, and the training.
And the shells and all the ammunition we're using, So that's a real reasonable number. In, you know, as things go up, birds and things will probably change. But I'd say, you know, anywhere from $600 to $800 for a couple weeks, you know, is probably a really normal number out there right now. Going on bird and gun, I think some people need to think is like, the world's changed a little bit. Let's go back to COVID. And I hate to even bring that up, but it was like a boom in dog sales. Everybody had more time to get a dog. More dogs were bought in that time frame. I mean, our business was off the charts booming during that time frame. Some advice that I'd give is pretty much at this point, if you buy a young dog and you know the dog's birthday and you know you're going to be going off to some training, I would get a hold of your trainer, book that training. That opens the door that if you have questions, you can ask those. Like if you call our facility and you get our office staff, they're going to get your information. They're going to want to get you in the books. But that opens up. They're going to say, do you have any other questions? And you go, well, I have these questions. Now, our staff in the office might go, well, that's a trainer question. I'm going to put you into the voicemail of one of our trainers so they can get back to you on that. And I think that's something that I'd really encourage is ask those questions. I have so many people come in and go, well, I'm here for bird and gun. Well, have you thrown any feathers? Well, no, I haven't. And then by the time we're done, God, I really wish I would have known that I was supposed to do that. So that might open the door to ask those questions right away when you get a puppy. But by booking the program, even in our program, you call and book the program. You go, you know what? I think I'm going to go a different direction. There's no penalties. There's no, it's just written in pencil in our books, right? We're not holding you to anything. So if you get a dog these days, I really advise that if you try to seek out somebody, get that plan. Now, some breeders provide all this into the package deal with a
dog.
When
you buy a pup,
That's kind of what we do when we sell labs. When you buy a dog from us, we already enroll this program into our puppy sale. Making sure the dog I sold you is coming back to us. We get to put on live birds. We get to gun break it. So when you're out searching for dogs, if you get that package deal, you know, that might be a good avenue for you as well. You know, there's a lot of people that buy puppies from all over the world, all over the country. You know, getting a dog enrolled in that, I would tell somebody that this program is the most valuable for a young hunting dog.
Mm-hmm.
You screw up this part, you don't have a hunting dog. Yeah. So we get a lot of customers that do this program, and then they do the rest themselves, and that's great. But they know they don't have libraries, they don't have the grounds to do this, but they know they can go out to the game farm and keep working on obedience and keep moving forward and then maybe make a few phone calls. So that's my biggest advice. If you're going to do any program for a young hunting dog, as you would attest, this two-week program really put your dog set up in a good position. And now you can walk away going, she knows what live birds are. She's been exposed to the gun properly. Now I can go to the game farm and continue this journey with her.
You know, the Tom Dockin name, and by virtue the Mike Wiebin name, right, is connected. It's intertwined with Labrador retrievers.
Sure.
Right? I mean, you Google search Labradors, and Dockin is top three name in the entire world that'll mm-hmm. come up. And I often get this question, Bob, why are you bringing your pointers to Mike and Dockins?
Yeah.
How would you answer that?
I think a little bit of that is just where we're located in the upper Midwest. I think there's a lot of flushing dogs in our area. You go down south, the pointing dog is king. You don't see as many flushing dogs. The further you go south, and you probably hunted down there, everybody has a pointer. You get up in the upper Midwest, you got, it just seems like it, there's more dogs that are being trained in this area that are for flushing. Now, do we train pointers? As you've seen, we train all kinds of pointers. But if I had to take a number out of 100, how many are pointers? Maybe 20, 25 out of 100. But I think it's just the area we're in. We just, this area, upper Midwest, you just see more people with flushing dogs than pointing dogs.
Yeah. I really value the expert nature with which you guys have on, particularly around retrieving. You know, and thankfully, you know, I've had this bloodline of short hairs where that's pretty natural point. And I've had mixed bag a little bit on retrieve, you know, a couple of that right out of the box phenomenal. Had a little bit more significant more work with Gitche.
Sure.
And Winter's very close bloodlines to Gitche, and I know the type of hunting I'm doing working for Pheasants Forever. You know, I'm going to break a lot of roosters' wings, and I am just a believer in having a super strong retrieving dog, even if it's a pointer, because I love my rough grouse and woodcock hunting.
Sure.
But the magic that happens when a short hair pointing dog gets on a crippled bird and brings it back to you.
Yeah, and you talk about us being retrieving, you know, kind of known as retriever trainers. Well, if you have a breed that kind of is naturally bred to point, and now you're bringing it to a guy that specializes in training a lot of retrieving training, you know, that really kind of put you in a position where that was the part you didn't have.
Yeah.
And she got put in a position where that's what we do.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where I go back to, like, yeah, upper Midwest is kind of known, and we are known. We sell labs. It's just kind of what's here. So that's kind of been the market for that. But pointers, in my opinion, there's only a couple things that you switch up, but a lot of the things really have a lot of similarities.
And you're savvy enough to see them, right? You guys see enough, and you're savvy enough to say, you know, your pup is sliding from a point into a sit.
Sure.
Here's what we got to do to course correct.
I mean, right now we got poodle pointers here. We got Vizslas here right now. We got Wimes here right now. We got short hairs right now.
Yeah.
We got wire hairs right now. I mean, so, you know, we have all those pointers still flowing through our process. It's just, I think, just in this area, you just see more flushing dogs.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'm a believer. I've had tremendous success, and I, you know, personally, thank you so much for the work you've done with Gitche and the path you've put me on with Winter.
Yeah, and now we got another one, and we're going to go down that path again. We're going to have some hope. Our goal is to have the same results, but how we get there is probably going to be just a little bit different here and there, how we get the next one to meet our expectations of what we want her to do. So
right on. And in a few months, I'll be back, and we'll talk about introducing e-collars.
Sure, absolutely.
All right. Thank you to Mike Wieben and Dawkins Oak Ridge Kennels for hosting us. And obviously, thank you to Purina Pro Plan and Sport Dog for sponsoring this episode of On the Wing podcast. I'm Bob St. Pierre, reminding you to always follow the dog. Something good will rise. Thanks for listening, folks.